Tonight on Arena, we preview Amazon's Nine Perfect Strangers and celebrate all things Handel at Handelfest Dublin. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Any Irish fan of Handel's Messiah may know that it was first performed in Dublin back in April of 1742, thus stealing a march on Handel's home from home, London, where he established himself in 1710. The Messiah's Dublin and international success rejuvenated Handel's then flagging career and re-established his superstardom once again across Europe. This weekend, the inaugural Dublin Handel Fest pays tribute to Handel's association with Dublin City, 280 years after he first arrived on these shores. The programme for Dublin Handel Fest has been put together by the Irish Baroque Orchestra, and I'm delighted to be joined by its artistic director, Peter Whelan, to tell me about the festival. And also on the line, we have soprano Julia Doyle, who will be performing music from Handel's opera, Acis and Galatea, as part of the festival. So, Peter, he had this intimate and successful association with Dublin. Yes, we put on the Messiah here a lot, but you would think that we would have put on festival after festival to have a splash about this, but no.
No, it's true. We've had a few goes over the last maybe 200 years of having a Handel festival in Ireland, and it never quite took off. So this is just, a new generation having another go at it, basically. There's so much for us to be proud of as Irish people, and our heritage in classical music isn't so well known to us, or at least to myself when I was growing up. It was... I only knew about Handel's Messiah being performed in Dublin. It's a huge fascination for me. But, when you travel around the world, people are really curious about what was happening in Ireland during the 18th century. And it's been my, my desire to discover more about the music scene in Ireland at the time. What did Handel find when he came over? Why did he come over? And it turns out that there was lots of really wonderful high-level music making in Dublin at the time, and it's our job to share this with as many people as we can.
So he left London, and did he leave London under a cloud, or he maybe damn squibbish? He wasn't doing as well as he was when he arrived there and established himself first.
Exactly. He had fallen on hard times. It's a very fickle business, kind of like, I guess, faddish, like maybe pop music would be nowadays. So at the beginning in London, he was the belle of the ball, and opera was everything. And he just kept producing the same thing again and again and again. And he had lots of competitors, and people just grew a little bit tired of opera in Italian. And they preferred things in English. So the Beggar's Opera came up, which is a big parody of Handel's music. And the kind of tide turned against him, and his health turned as well. And, he was investing a lot of money in all of these operas. So it was a difficult time for him. And it was just the perfect time for an invitation to Dublin to come. And there was a man called Matthew de Bourg, who was a violinist, and he was working in Dublin Castle and travelling between London and Ireland. And he probably had a lot to do with having invited Handel over. He saw a good business opportunity for him. Dublin was the second biggest city in the British Isles at the time. So he just had a good feeling about it. Like, there was lots of building going on. There were lots of artists travelling over. It was worth travelling over the Irish Sea. And so, yeah, Handel took a risk, and it really paid off for him. His fortunes changed. He earned a lot of money when he was over here. A lot of hospitality. We know that as soon as he stepped off the boat, before he could even unpack his clothes and his instruments, he was whisked out and wined and dined. There might be even evidence that he had so much to drink at one point he had a mini stroke, but he was in the house of the Surgeon General, so he was saved. But definitely, by the time he left Ireland, he experimented, with these new forms. Messiah was such a big deal.
And did he have the Messiah in his pocket when he came over, or was it in Dublin that he composed it?
Well, he composed it before he left. So he had composed it in London, and he didn't quite know where to perform it. So he was testing the waters with Irish audiences. He had six concerts beforehand, and he was just seeing what the players were like in Ireland, who the singers were. And I think he decided that it was a good place to unleash this piece, a controversial piece because it's a religious setting. It's not an opera, so it's just a concert version. And it was performed in Fishamble Street in a secular building, which is really a big risk. You know, you had people coming from the cathedral, including Dean Swift, who wasn't at all happy with his singers being involved in that. So Handel knew how to put on a big and scandalous event for the first show.
And tell us about the soprano that he brought over. She had a little whiff of scandal off her as well, didn't she?
Exactly. So he had a few singers who he brought over on the royal yacht, including one Italian soprano. And she didn't travel the normal way. So she was on the viceregal yacht. So she was a very special person. But we also have this woman called Susanna Kibber, who came over and she was avoiding a sex scandal in London. She was all over the papers for this affair she had. And she thought that she could quietly slip away to Dublin and escape all of this. But of course, everybody knew all about her. And Handel used her to great effect in the first performance of Messiah. The Dublin version is ever so slightly different from the version we know today. And each of the thirds has an aria in the middle for this woman, Susanna Kibber, begging forgiveness and comparing herself to a lamb and saying, you know, the famous aria is, "He was despised." So you recognise, herself in the text, and Handel knew this would also have an amazing effect. She was a brilliant actress, not such a great singer, but that didn't matter to Handel. He was happy to train her up. And during the performance, in fact, one of the deacons from Patrick's Cathedral is said to have screamed out, "Woman, for this thy sins be forgiven thee." So he even won over the clerics with that one.
So real life was there in the middle of the performance, reflecting what was happening in the music. That's amazing.
Absolutely. And a manufactured scandal by Handel too, for more ticket sales, no doubt.
So Julia Doyle is your soprano. No comparison at all to that Italian hussy that we were speaking about earlier. Julia, we're going to speak to you in a moment, but let's hear you singing Rejoice Greatly from the Messiah first. Julia Doyle there singing Rejoice Greatly from the Messiah. Robert King there directing the King's Concert Orchestra. Julia Doyle, you're very welcome on Arena here with Peter Whelan from the Irish Baroque Orchestra. What is it like
to
sing? Thank you for joining us. What is it like to sing Handel? Is it a soprano's dream or is he tricky?
Ooh, possibly both. I absolutely adore singing Handel. I spend my whole life singing Bach and Handel, basically. And Bach is a real favourite of mine. But he never lets you breathe. He writes these incredible instrumental lines with absolutely nowhere to breathe. And that's what I love about Handel. He really understood the human voice, I feel. And wrote, it's very singable. It's a real pleasure to sing, you know, these mellifluous lines, which really show how well he understood the human voice. So I think it's a dream. It has its tricky moments, obviously, like those semiquavers you just heard.
There's a lot of them.
There are a lot of them, and mine seem to slow down as I get older, sadly. No, but I love it. I absolutely love it.
So obviously Messiah is not part of the Handel Fest, but the opera Acis and Galatea, which is performed in concert form, is, and you are playing the part of Galatea. Tell us a little bit about the opera, Julia, and the part.
Well, I'm new to this piece, actually. I've sung it once now, which was a few weeks ago, and I jumped in at the last minute at 24 hours notice. So this is my first proper performance. And everyone said for years, you should sing Galatea. And now I see why. It's just such a glorious part. Galatea, the heroine, is, I think, an extraordinarily lyrical and positive young lady. She's besotted with her lover Acis, and they have this incredible, unbreakable love, and they're utterly loyal to each other. And yeah, she's very, very perky and positive, even faced with this brutal, I shouldn't give away the plot, but the brutal murder of her lover Acis in front of her eyes, as he's dashed with a stone. She's still, you only momentarily really see her raw emotion, and then she gets a handle on it and she turns it around and says, we're going to turn him into a river so he can live on flowing as this river. And I just feel she just sees the best in life, which is something we can all aspire to.
Well, Julia, as you said, you have not yet performed this in front, professionally in front of an audience. So we have a little sample from Acis and Galatea. This is Dawn Katofsky, the soprano with the Seattle Symphony Chorale. And this is the aria, Must I Acis Still Bemoan? That's Must I My Acis Still Bemoan from Acis and Galatea. There was Dawn Katofsky, the soprano, with the Seattle Symphony Chorale and the Seattle Symphony Orchestra under Gerhard Schwartz. Now, Peter Whelan of the Irish Baroque Orchestra, you're going to be conducting, playing the harpsichord and conducting this concert version of the opera.
That's right. So I'll be directing from the harpsichord, which is the older version of conducting. Because the group is so small, it works better if it's led from the harpsichord. And that's maybe what Handel would have done when he was in Dublin. In fact, he did more than that. He played organ concertos during the intervals, during the breaks. So it would have been a very long evening, if, for instance, Messiah at the time. But for our Acis in St. Patrick's Hall in Dublin Castle, yes, I'll be directing from the harpsichord, a very small group of people. Acis is an absolutely wonderful work, but it's a very small scale work as well, which is perfect for the times we're living in.
And is that the way Handel would have done it? Would he have been at his harpsichord conducting his orchestra?
That's
and his
right,
singers?
Yeah. He would. He would have coached them beforehand, and during the concerts, he would have always been playing. So it's a little bit like the rhythm and bass section of the orchestra. You can really drive things from the harpsichord. The team of harpsichord, cello, bass, and lute together are called the basso continuo, and they give all the drive to the singers and to the upper voices. So that's basically how Baroque music hangs together.
So, Julia, have you been rehearsing this with Peter, or is that in the next week or so?
No. This is the when I arrive will be the first rehearsal. This is the first time I'm speaking to him for quite a while, actually.
You can say hello to each other there. And Julia, so you, at least it will be a live rehearsal, because I was wondering, would it be one of those technical Zoom rehearsals? So that at least is a relief.
Absolutely. I actually have been incredibly fortunate. I haven't had to do any of those. I can't really honestly imagine how it works. It must be incredibly frustrating. And, you know, it's making music is such, you have to be together in person, really. So I'm very lucky I haven't had to do that. And it will be so thrilling just to be in a room with fellow musicians doing what we do.
And I hope for you, who loves Handel and has performed Handel so much, that going to perform in Dublin is going to be a treat.
Of course. Oh, it's really special performing in a city with such a strong connection to Handel. And it's really magical walking in his footsteps. Slightly daunting in a way. It brings the performance to a whole new level, but it's really special, actually. I'm looking forward to it. I think last time I was in Dublin was performing the Messiah a million years ago, which was also incredibly special. And to be back, I've got family in Ireland, so it'll be lovely to be back in Ireland.
Indeed. And Peter, everybody will be able to see this because only the singers and the performers can be in St. Patrick's Hall. So it's going to be streamed.
That's right. It's going to be live streamed. So there'll still be a frisson of excitement and of live performance there. And over the weekend, then we have several other events.
Yes, tell us about those. You've the walking tour.
That's right. And there's a long tradition of the walking tour. Barry Boydell used to do it for years. This year, of course, it has to be slightly different. So we're walking around the sites near Fishamble Street, Christchurch Cathedral, all of the theatres, Dublin Castle, and that'll be online. And Laura Sheeran helped us to record it with like drone footage. So we're making the best of the situation, and you can follow that online. And then there's also the wonderful Irish Youth Baroque Orchestra who will be, they'll be streaming a concert of theirs. And Malcolm Proud will be has recorded a concert from the Chapel Royal in Dublin Castle as well. He's a wonderful harpsichord player. And that will also be over the weekend.
Now, we're going to finish with the track Hibernian Sun, or Hibernian Suns. This is a Handel piece. Will you introduce it to us for us?
Yeah, of course. This is a really favourite piece of mine. And actually, it sounds exactly like it's by Handel, but it's not. It's by this guy, Matthew Dubourg, this violinist who invited him to Dublin. Matthew Dubourg was the Master of State Music in Dublin Castle. And it was his job to write music for royal occasions. So he had to do things twice a year. He was a very reluctant composer, and you can imagine him going to Handel asking for advice, and this is one of those pieces. You can feel Handel leaning over Matthew Dubourg's shoulder, telling him how to write these kind of ceremonial pieces.
Yes, you can definitely hear Handel leaning over Matthew Dubourg as he wrote Hibernia's Sons, Your Voices Raise, from Ode for Dublin Castle, written in 1753. My thanks to Peter Whelan, Artistic Director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra, and Julia Doyle, soprano, who will be performing in St. Patrick's Hall this Friday at 7:30 p.m., taking the role of Galatea in Handel's opera Acis and Galatea. You can find out full details about that and all the rest of the programme on the Handel Festival website, dublinhandelfest.com. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. In Nine Perfect Strangers, nine stressed city dwellers visit a boutique health and wellness resort that promises healing and transformation. The resort's director, Masha, played by Nicole Kidman, is a woman on a mission to reinvigorate their tired minds and bodies. The guests soon come to realise that Tranquillium House is unlike any place they've ever been before, and not in a good way. This is an adaptation of Big Little Lies author Leanne Moriarty's novel Nine Perfect Strangers. I'm joined now by Jen Gannon to tell us more. So it's David E. Kelly and Nicole Kidman reunited in Nine Perfect Strangers, and this is following on from their huge success in Big Little Lies, but it's quite a different premise.
Anybody who was, you know, really involved in those luncheon ladies in Monterey, it's going to be very, very different from that, because it's such a high concept in a way, rather than getting to know the women that you did in Big Little Lies over the course of two seasons. This is really just concentrated on this sole group of strangers being thrown together, and their, you know, disparate interests and what that involves, and drawing out the darkness below the surface of what's going on in their lives. So it's very contained. It's a very contained drama.
Yes, very classic, very Agatha Christie,
yeah, almost. Yeah.
Yes. So can you tell us a little about the guests, the nine perfect strangers, and then there's the staff?
You've pretty much got everyone. Everyone has their own reasons for checking in. And as you discover as you go along, Masha, played by Nicole Kidman, she has chosen them for a reason to all be together. They're all connected. They become connected in in certain ways. So you have a grief-stricken family, and the head of that family is played by Michael Shannon, and he is this almost Ned Flanders-like, I have to say, maths teacher, which is so different from anything you've ever seen Michael Shannon do. You're kind of used to him being borderline psychotic, moody characters, but this is, he's very over the top, very gregarious, and his family are suffering from the death of his son, their teenage son. And then you have Bobby Cannavale as this OxyContin addicted ex-football player, and Melissa McCarthy as this struggling romance novelist. She's at this crossroads in her life to do with her career, but also she's fallen for this scam artist, this Romeo, internet Romeo scam artist. So she's dealing with that, the shame of that. And then you have a lottery winning couple whose marriage is on the rocks. And then you have Regina Hall, who plays this kind of character who's in an abusive relationship and as a people pleaser and is trying to get out of that kind of frame of mind as well.
And then there's the Luke Evans character.
Who you can't really give too much away about other to say that he is quite irritating.
Well, let's reintroduce to two of the characters you just talked about there. After receiving some bad news about our latest book, Frances, the Melissa McCarthy character, pulls over to shout into the wilderness. This is as she's driving to Tranquillium. She quickly finds she's not alone when Tony, played by Bobby Cannavale, stops his car to check on her.
Hello? You okay? Do you need some help, miss?
No, I'm good.
You don't seem good.
Well, I was just having a quiet moment of despair.
Okay, well, that's your idea of a quiet moment? Because you seem... You're screaming like a banshee, that's why I pulled over.
Well, I'm sorry. I apologize. Okay. I thought I was in the middle of nowhere, completely alone. Clearly, that is not the case.
Are you sick?
I beg your pardon?
You seem to be having some kind of a mental breakdown episode sort of thing. I'm not judging. You know, I've got mental illness in my own family.
Is that right? I'm fine.
You know, it's not normal to be screaming dead to the fucking world at the top of your lungs, you know?
You know what it is? I was having a hot flash.
Oh.
So I'm good. Thank you so much.
Do you take supplements?
I'm sorry.
Progesterone? Progesterone. I heard that helps.
Are we actually having this conversation right now?
What's with the tone, lady?
I don't have a tone. I am just not used to complete strangers prescribing hormone replacement therapy. Curbside!
Apologies. I can see now that you're a tragic person. Have a good day.
Not a great introductory line, really. That's Bobby Cannavale as Tony and Frances played by Melissa McCarthy. They're a great two-hander, aren't they?
I think they're the best thing about it for me. Anyway, they have this great odd couple comic chemistry, and they're a joy to watch together, and it kind of made me wish they had their own spin-off away from the actual story itself. I just wanted to see them holiday together and kind of bicker and lob jibes at each other all day, because that they're the most entertaining parts of the series for me.
Yes, because as you say, the Michael Shannon family is a very tragic family. Everybody comes with their own heartbreak, even the Melissa McCarthy. Mm. But some things are played for laughs, and then there are elements that are played very seriously. Yeah. So is it drama or comedy drama?
It's a mix. And that's the kind of problem I do have with it, because I think with Big Little Lies, David E. Kelly managed to successfully segue from comedy to drama. And with Nine Perfect Strangers, it's a lot clunkier, I think. And it swings wildly from broad farce to oftentimes mawkish, bordering on mawkish melodrama for me, depending on which character they're concentrating on. And it's hard to really know what they're aiming for at times. You don't know, should we really be invested in the Masha character as a three-dimensional character? She has a backstory herself, and that's never really properly delved into. And you don't really know, does she want to actually help these people? Is she a charlatan? Is she just extremely misguided? Or is she just this symbol, this agent of chaos? Is she just a symbolic representation representation. What I do know is that Nicole Kidman does not get enough to do. And Nicole Kidman is, you know, Oscar winner Nicole Kidman. She should be a lot more present in this series.
Okay, Jen, maybe we'll introduce the Masha character to the listeners, and then we'll talk about her a bit more. This is Masha, who is the leader and the guru at Tranquillium, played by Nicole Kidman. In this clip, she greets the guests and tells them what they can expect at Tranquillium. And then Lars is the Luke Evans character. He notices that he is missing some items from his luggage.
Namaste. Welcome to Tranquillium House. Right now you are at the foot of a mountain, and the summit, it seems impossibly far away, but I'm going to help you reach that summit. In 10 days, you will leave here. You will not be the person that you are now. You will leave Tranquillium House and you will feel happier, healthier, lighter, freer. And on the last day of your stay, you will come to me and you will say, yes, Masha, Masha, you were right. I'm not the same person. I'm not the same person that I was. I'm healed. I am free. Free of the negative habits and chemicals and toxins and thoughts that were holding me back. My mind and my body are clear. And I am changed in ways I could never have imagined.
Did you go through our bags? Because I seem to be missing a few things.
Yes, you are missing chocolate and wine, as is Francis.
Well, I mean, they're both antioxidants, so...
Nicole Kidman there as Masha from Nine Perfect Strangers. She's the guru of this Tranquillium House where all the nine perfect strangers come to be made well. She's obviously not Australian in that clip.
No.
Obviously not American, but where she's from is a little unsure.
She's kind of like where the Russia where Kenneth Branagh is from in Tenet, I think. Like, I mean, Melissa McCarthy's character describes her as a mystical Eastern Bloc unicorn. And that is perfect because she just is this ethereal being that kind of borders on looking like one of the elvish people from Lord of the Rings. She's basked in this glow, this kind of gauzy glow all the time, which kind of makes me feel like she almost looks like she's animated. She doesn't look like a real person. And she just kind of dispenses this wisdom about suffering and being reborn in this, you know, kind of Bond villain accent. And but she also, you see a slightly some of Masha's backstory where you see that she has a past that she's trying to escape from, just like she's, you know, seeking a salvation like her guests in the house itself. So as the story develops, the facade drops for everybody and she's asking them to give in to a death almost. And you see them at one point digging their own makeshift graves. And, you know, for me, it was a bit like Fantasy Island meets Lord of the Flies, kind of. And I think it does touch on, you know, the wellness industry as a whole, which
yes, because there's one talk she gives and it's quite alluring. You know, she says after 10 days, you'll go away completely changed. And, you know, they have to go through all these processes, burying themselves, foraging, loads of things to become new people. And I guess that is part of the wellness industry in, you know, maybe an extreme form of it. But it is quite attractive, perhaps, for people who have problems and heartbreak and the
and
like.
Money, especially, I think. And I think that's the thing. I think at the moment we're seeing this in the arts, in a lot of media, this kind of interrogation of our relationship with the wellness industry and how this new dogged pursuit of perfection disguised as healthcare can not only be vacuous but can also be sometimes insidious. And we've had it with
a bit cult-like.
Yeah, we've had M. Night Shyamalan coming out with Old, like it's a pulpy horror, but it does look around at our fears around death and disease. And then The White Lotus as well, that touches on, you know, the wealthy ideal of wellness. And I think with Nine Perfect Strangers, it does want to skewer our blind belief in these transformative powers of this what is a luxury industry now and what is closed off to some people. And is for others. It's somewhere that the elite can have.
And does it point fun at it? Or
yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of Gwyneth Paltrow's goop in there, definitely, but mixed with a bit of a Jonestown edge to it. That's the way I would describe Masha.
Okay, so we may be heading to Jonestown, are we?
I mean, they're not exactly drinking Kool-Aid, they're drinking fancy cocktails. But
Now, you've said that there are 9 perfect strangers rock up to Tranquillium. How does she go about then, you know, because it's hard when you're watching or reading this kind of thing, to differentiate the group and then to dig deeper with each individual. Does that happen progressively over the episode?
It does. And I think, see, the problem I was getting with it was the fact that it doesn't deal in, the characterization is more broad, it's more caricature than 3-dimensional characters, I found. I think you're dealing in archetypes here more than anything, and that kind of makes it, rather than something that can be a little bit, have a little bit more depth to it, it actually made it feel a little bit shallow. Sometimes I was watching it thinking it was more like an elevated soap opera than anything else, and I think Big Little Lies did it so well, where it could, you know, it had those issues. Like someone with, like Regina Hall's character, who I said is in this abusive relationship, and I think she's actually wasted on this character because she's such a great actress. We've seen this character before, a people pleaser with this deep-seated rage stemming from an abusive relationship. We've seen it done in actually Big Little Lies with Nicole Kidman and how well she did that and how measured that performance was. But David E. Kelly made the decision not to write this for the screen himself, which he did with Big Little Lies. So there is other writers here. And I think maybe relinquishing the control was perhaps a bad idea, because I think it's turned it into something else with a more comic edge to it.
So overall, you're quite disappointed, I think, in 9 Perfect Strangers.
I mean, it's beautifully shot. It's highly bingeable. And it's a superficial slice of entertainment that could be the perfect escape for some and will probably appeal to more people than the very bitter and deeply unpleasant inhabitants of The White Lotus. But for me, The White Lotus is the prestige drama to watch now with a huge ensemble cast. And I was dissatisfied. I just wanted a little more depth with my cucumber water, for sure.
Great. My thanks to Jen Gannon. 9 Perfect Strangers begins streaming on Amazon Prime on the 20th of August. A few weeks back on Arena, we reviewed the second album from Billie Eilish entitled Happier Than Ever. At the age of just 19, Billie Eilish has become one of the most significant pop music artists in the world right now. And that success owes a huge amount to her brother, her collaborator and producer, Phineas. Here, Phineas has recently signed his own record deal and has just announced that his debut album will arrive on October the 15th and will be called Optimist. With 8 Grammy Awards already under his own belt and still only 24, this promises to be one of the most anticipated releases later in 2021. Last week, Phineas released a new song which will be taken from that album. This is called A Concert, 6 months from now.
Your favorite band is back on the road, and this fall they're playing the Hollywood Bowl. I've already purchased 2 seats for their show.
A Concert, 6 months from now, from Phineas. It's just about 7:45. Sarah works in Arnott's, wants to get into journalism and swims in the sea every day. Helen is a retired piano teacher, spending a lot of time online. They meet when Sarah phones Helen as part of research for a feature she is writing about conspiracy theories. Neptune Calling is a new play by Owen Quinn with Evine McCann and Geraldine Plunkett, exploring how we connect with others and what our coping mechanisms are in a time of crisis. Both inspired by lockdown last year. Tracy Martin directs for Red Bear Productions. I'm delighted to say that Tracy Martin and Owen Quinn join me now. Tracy here in studio and Owen on the line. Tracy, Neptune Calling is being staged outdoors and it goes on tour that takes in 3 venues with the audience on deck chairs wearing headphones. So what are they looking at?
They're looking at a gorgeous set that's been designed by Marie Kearns. It's as if it's dropped down from heaven. It's reflecting the sky back at us. It's a platform that our dancer climbs up on top of, and it's lit with from within for when she talks to the sea. Our main point of having the deck chairs and having the headphones was we wanted to make sure we could make almost a COVID-proof production, that if we went into lockdown again and if it's, you know, if we had to like segregate so much, that we could still keep bringing theatre around.
Yes, because I introduced the two characters mm-hmm. there. There's Sarah, the would-be journalist. There's Helen, the piano teacher. Mm-hmm. And they, in their own way, are trying to cope with being in lockdown. Tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. They've both gone quite separate about it. Sarah is it's almost like she's numbing herself with the sea about it every day as she goes for her sea swims. But Helen is a bit more proactive in doing what she calls research, and she's questioning any type of authority decision that's been made, and that's made her quite spiky. And that's why Sarah is so interested in reading, interviewing her. Helen's quite prolific on Facebook pages and likes to get her opinion out there, whereas Sarah doesn't really know how to figure out what's going on around her.
Right. And this is the conversation, these mm-hmm. phone conversations that the audience are going to hear yeah. on their headphones yeah. as they sit in their deck chairs mm-hmm. watching a dance piece.
Yeah, so Robin Byrne is embodying both Sarah and Helen and the sea and many other phone conversations that are going on. Robin Byrne's a fantastic performer, and we wanted to bring an extra physicality to people who may not normally watch dance. We wanted to fill it with as much theatre and dance as possible.
So you commissioned the writer, Owen mm-hmm. Quinn, who joins us. So, Owen, you and I guess Tracy had a lot of conversations. What was the brief?
Well, something Tracy mentioned from the start was that this would be a story about connection. And, you know, she told me kind of how it was going to be delivered over headphones, this kind of aural experience. So, you know, we talked a lot about telephone calls early on. I tried to boil it down to what I thought might be its most basic element, which was listening to a relationship just develop between two strangers, and we're kind of listening in. And from there, it was just, you know, who are these people? Why are we listening to this relationship in particular? And I was really interested in writing a character who was older and becoming increasingly interested in conspiracy theories. And as that character emerged, so did, you know, Sarah kind of in response. I thought it would be interesting that she would have her own sort of lockdown obsession, even though it's very different, that these very different people, like all of us, are really finding strategies to cope with the sort of very difficult emotions that have cropped up from the pandemic.
And these two subjects, sea swimming and conspiracy mm. theories, of course, became very much the currency during lockdown.
Yeah, that was the idea, really. We felt that they kind of made an interesting marriage. You know, sea swimming is almost kind of uncontroversially healthy, a good thing to be doing, and conspiracy theories obviously are a lot more dangerous. So it was kind of interesting, we thought, to juxtapose them and to ask questions about how different people cope with what they're feeling at the moment.
So we'll play a clip from the play. Here we meet Sarah, played by Evie McCann, for the first time.
And look, I'm well aware that of all the things to happen this year, what happened to me is not the most important. It's not the worst. I'm fine. But at the same time, I'm not going to pretend it's out of context for all this, all right? Because it is, obviously. I'm sorry, but it's there. Like, it's just, it's real life lingering in the background, shadowing everything we do, like a clumsy transition year student on work experience. And you can't tell this kind of story without context, okay? Okay? Good. So there was this one night, a night in April. I was driving through town. It was one of the wettest days of the year, you might remember it. This unceasing biblical storm. It was flooding. Cats and dogs. I'm talking Angela's Ashes meets Blade Runner in the rainforest. And I was hurtling along the road through town and then out to the coast. My little Subaru ferrying me along like some ancient loyal horse. And the thing about that night is that... And yeah, I know this sounds crazy, but... I thought I heard the sea calling my name. Which is Sarah, by the way.
Evian McCann there playing Sarah. Tracy, it's quite, we see there that she is sea swimming. This is supposed to be such a positive thing to do. But for her, it brings up not only positive things.
Yeah, I think for her, you know, as she starts to interview Helen and starts to kind of question Helen's mental health, we start to see that even though she's using the sea as a coping mechanism, that possibly there's something that's just a tiny bit unraveling with herself, and it's Helen who was the stronger minded and who was probably not to be questioned so much as Sarah, who was drifting off and not facing things.
Helen's character, played by Geraldine Plunkett, she's a pretty spiky character, isn't she? Mm. And she can read Sarah even down a phone line as to what Sarah is up to try and find somebody that she can poke and prod and find out about what her conspiracy theories are, with the feeling that Sarah has about Helen that she's pretty wacky.
Yeah, totally. I think that's probably something maybe that emerges a little bit under lockdown as well. You know, the lack of meaningful social contact in a way leads you to sort of seek that from one another, perhaps in those kind of spikier ways. But she's also, you know, someone who's very online. And so that sort of warps her perception of the external world and how other people are experiencing the world, you know. So she's very strong-willed as a result.
And Tracy, did you have any qualms about the subject of conspiracy theories? Because anybody on social media will know how controversial it is. And
no, I mean, I think it's. I'm hoping for some juicy conversations afterwards. You know, I think if people are going to be sticking around to have the chats, I think that's where it'll all come out, and people will have their own experiences of. Whether their own thoughts or family members' thoughts or friends who've started to just get interested in different things, I think this is the perfect opportunity to talk about it and to face what we're drowning with all the stuff online on social media. Do you know, we're being hit by it all the time.
And Dawn, the two women do find, not to give away any plot, but they do find common ground, don't they? They are looking for something else, maybe a friendship, maybe a connection, maybe they just kind of like each other.
Yeah, for sure. You know, they do develop a relationship, you know, and a friendship, even if it's kind of presented in this often sort of spiky or, you know, ironic way where they can't quite say it to one another. But for sure, I think something that they're both experiencing in very different ways is loneliness, you know, and going back to kind of the brief when I was talking to Tracy, you know, that really what we wanted to explore was connection, especially in this context of crisis, you know, and crisis management and how all those things sort of fit together, you know.
And Tracy, so this is going to be outside. Mm-hmm. In an Access, Ballymun, Civic Theatre, Tala, Dreach, Blanchardstown. So have you talked with the venues? Are you, mm-hmm. you have obviously agreed.
We are going around to 18 different locations. We're going to gardening clubs. We're going to the top of outdoor car parks. We're going to rehab groups, OAP groups. We're going everywhere that we can get the van into and get the set out onto. We really want to... A part of the brief for the tour was, okay, who hasn't possibly experienced live theatre, if not even recently, possibly for a while. And
that's many of us,
yeah,
indeed.
Exactly, yeah. You know?
Well, excellent. Neptune Calling runs in locations near Access, Ballymun, Civic Theatre, Tala and Dreach, Blanchardstown from the 21st of August to the 12th of September. All details from redbearcompany.ie. Tracy and Owen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Lord is the stage name of New Zealand singer-songwriter Ella Yelich O'Connor. Her breakthrough debut album, Pure Heroine, was released in 2013, and the following year she was listed as one of Time magazine's most influential teenagers. Now 8 years on, at the age of 24, and with two Grammy Awards, two Brit Awards and a Golden Globe nomination under her belt, she's about to release her third studio album. It's called Solar Power. It's one of the three we will be reviewing this Friday's on Arena, and here is the title track, Solar Power.
Let the bliss begin. Blink three times when you feel it kicking in. That's
Lord's new track, Solar Power, from her new album of the same name, Solar Power, which is one of the albums we're going to be reviewing on Friday. So we'll see what our reviewers make of that. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Mark McGraw was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Ola McGann.